To mark the decade of centenaries, this series, in conjunction with the Donegal County Museum, explores Donegal women in the revolutionary period, stories of the First World War from behind the walls, the Irish Grants Committee and the last letters of Drumbow. This first episode, with myself, Michaela Clark, focuses on the untold stories of Donegal women in the revolutionary period. In recognising the role of women in shaping Ireland during this time, the role of the revolutionary figure Ethna Coyle and the establishment of Cumann na mBan is explored. Caroline Carr, assistant curator with Donegal County Museum, begins by explaining the background of the revolutionary period.
Revolutionary period covers, you know, the War of Independence, Civil War and partition and border. So, you know, the 1919 to 1925 period. Even before that, between 1912 and 1925, this is an extraordinary alteration in Ireland's history, in which the known political and social structures were contested, altered and reformed. So Ireland went from a country under British rule to a partitioned island and a free state.
And we know through newspaper articles from the time, through even watching films based back then, that it is all men portrayed, but there's women involved as well. There's women that are left at home, but there's women that get themselves involved and set up their own organisation.
You're totally true, Michaela. This period, everybody assumes our history is told through the actions of men. But alas, now we're actually recognising the extraordinary role that ordinary, everyday women played to shape in Ireland and to shape in our county during these turbulent times. And like during the War of Independence and Civil War, women were often members of nationalist organisations, including Cumann na mBan. But they were often the breadwinner when the men of the house or the husband of the house of the families were involved in revolutionary actions or on the run away from home. And they had to keep everything going while being part of maybe Cumann na mBan or other organisations.
And how did this Cumann na mBan come about? Did it originate here in Donegal or was it a national organisation?
It was a national organisation. It was founded in April 1914, even before the Easter Rising. The members, they acted as auxiliaries to the Military Council of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, or known as the IRB, and then the Irish Citizens Army and the Irish Volunteers and Sinn Féin, the Sinn Féin of that period. And they also played a huge role, important role, in the Easter Rising in 1916, which was only came to light recently as well, because they're another part of our hidden history. There is, of course, a huge Donegal figure. Well, not alone one Donegal woman, but there's lots of other Donegal women, and a lot of their stories have never come to light. But the most prominent member of Cumann na mBan is Ethna Coyle. And she was born over in Cullalt in 1897, and her parents were farmers, and her family had very strong Republican supporters. So in 1917, she joined Cumann na mBan, and in 1918, she co-founded the Clonmealy Cumann na mBan. And between 1918 and 1919, she lived in Dungannon as a Gaelic League organiser before she was moved to County Longford to set up a Cumann na mBan branches there. And she was also the Gaelic League organiser in Roscommon, where she acted as an IRA courier. And there's a great quote from her saying, "I was out at all hours doing this work and frequently met the back and tans and lanes and byroads swinging their guns in a threatening fashion. I was always very glad, especially late at night on lonely roads, to get safely past them. My knees often trembled as I pedalled along my bicycle. I was often held up and questioned, but it always happened that these particular groups of black and tans did not know me by sight." So she took the same risks as IRA men, and she endured the same hardships. And she was one of the few women that carried arms on her person. And eventually she was arrested. She was arrested in 1st January 1921 and was charged with possession of Cumann na mBan documents and a plan of Beechwood Barracks, and was later tried and sentenced to 3 years and was imprisoned in Mount Doyle Jail. So later on, afterwards, her sentence was commuted to 1 year. But on Halloween night in 1921, along with Linda Cairns, Mary Burke and Aileen Keogh, they all dramatically escaped. Extraordinary story. And there they went off to hiding down in Duckins Grove in County Carlow at the IRA training camp, where they remained until the Anglo-Irish Treaty was signed in 1921. After that, then, she eventually returned home to County Donegal. She was anti-treaty side. She didn't support the Anglo-Irish Treaty. And then she was appointed organiser at Cumann na mBan for County Donegal, Derry, Tyrone, and in attempt to increase membership because it was kind of fading at that stage.
Ethna Coyle's story was to take another interesting path when the Civil War broke out and Commandant Charlie Daly would send a dispatch rider and ask her to report immediately for active service under his command.
She was official dispatch carrier for the 1st Northern and 3rd Western Division. And then she was asked to organise first aid posts in the anti-treaty HQ in Donegal, which is Glenveagh Castle. And then she was based along the border as well. at Clody, where a lot of fighting took place. She actually took part, and one of the few women to take part in fights. Yeah. With the B specials as well, and that she's extraordinary. She's, you know, fearless.
Yeah,
fearless, and she was as capable as the men, or even more capable than their men.
And hearing her breaking out of prison, like, it was a real revolutionary figure. But she doesn't get the credit for being a part of that.
She doesn't, and even to search her records, her Coming the Man records, her pension records, it's under her husband's name. You know, and she had to fight for her pension. You know, she had extraordinary supporting documents and statements and references from the lead officers and lead men at the time. And even she had to fight for her pittance of her pension. And she was one of the most extraordinary revolution women we had in Ireland, not alone in Donegal. She was infamous around the world as well. She was reported on in papers from America, Australia and everywhere in between in India. She carried out a one woman unsanctioned campaign on the Lough Swilly and Londonderry Railway, the prolonged, I don't know how they survived. So she helped enforce the Belfast boycott. Belfast boycott was the boycotting of goods originally from Belfast, or British goods, which included newspapers or sweets or biscuits. And the trains were stopped and held up, and any of those goods were seized or reputedly destroyed, but usually taken away for supplies with anti-treaty forces. She used to hold up, and she did it so frequently that the trains would stop and just they'd let her in and have a look. She'd take out the British newspapers, dramatically set fire to them on the platforms, and then they let the train go as well. And she used a revolver, but it turns out the revolver was broken. It was never going to fire anyway. She was so well known that they used to just let her go on ahead so it wouldn't hold up the train.
English newspapers deserve to be burned. Every last one of them. Echanilla Hianaku. We don't need their propaganda lies here in Donegal. My fire is good enough for them. Up and smoke they go. Shenandoah. Take an action, like I did. Disrupt trade, disrupt distribution, all that maddens them. And it's my mission to madden them as much as I can. Nínart go Corlachéile. Buy local, buy Irish. Hit them where it hurts, at the till, at the market, at the bank. Burn those English newspapers. Propaganda, that's all they are. Lies, that's all they write, and their one-sided, lopsided paper stories. Join with me, and let's go at it, Giara.
The words there of Ethna Coyle describing her anti-treaty campaign during the Civil War. Her efforts, however, saw her become the first woman to be arrested during the war.
She was arrested numerous times by the pro-treaty forces, only to be released every time, and she thought being a woman would save her. But eventually there was a crackdown by the Free State government, and she was arrested, and she's the first woman arrested during the Civil War, which was September 1922, and she's held at the Rocks Barracks, and she assumed that she was going to be released, but she wasn't, and she's the first member of Coming the Man to go on hunger strike as well.
And even back then, you know, we associate hunger strike with a different time now, but back then,
as like, a means of protest and protest to her conditions, because as she was the first woman prisoner, they had no facilities for women. They didn't know how to deal with women prisoners. They didn't know how to, you know, the conditions for women were horrendous, and their needs and wants weren't cared for. So that's why she had to protest against the terrible conditions she was being held about. And then she was transferred to Mountjoy, where she organised herself and several other Coming the Man prisoners to strike against the terrible prison conditions. Then on 7th of May, she escaped again with 20 others, but only to be recaptured the following day. So after that, they made sure she remained in jail till after the Civil War ended. And in 1923, then, she's appointed to the Executive Council of Coming the Man. And in 1926, then, following the resignation of Countess Markovitch, she's elected to Coming the Man until 1941. And her story is, you know, it's a hidden story, you know, and people don't know very little of her. Like, she was never a member of Sinn Féin. She never was a member of any political party. She was a one woman, dedicated woman to the cause of Coming the Man.
Yeah.
She's an extraordinary character.
You can nearly kind of visualise her, you know, going onto the trains and you kind of visualise it in black and white and seeing her, you know, just in the dead of night, going about her business.
Oh yeah, and being a courier, and, you know, getting past, you know, checkpoints, and carrying arms, carrying dispatch messages, and travelling huge distances at night on her own. And no wonder she was afraid. But she was an extraordinary woman.
And why would she have gotten involved? Would it have been through her family? You talked about them earlier.
Yeah, they would have been involved in the land war and the land league at the time. So she would have had a strong kind of political background. And she just the activities of Come the Man suited her perfectly as well to her cause.
But she was a real leading figure then for the country.
Unfortunately, during the Civil War, she was in prison. She was imprisoned and they made sure that she didn't try to escape again. But then she was elected of Come the Man in 1941. But fortunately, after the Civil War and things like that, politics had changed and, you know, the rights of women had basically been eroded again, you know, after when Emma de Valera came to power and women's rights were slowly being changed. So the activist role of women were kind of changed again. So unfortunately, she resigned in 1941.
So the Come the Man in Donegal, would there have been a large uptake at the time?
Well, around the time of the, you know, the when the War of Independence, there would have been quite a large number active and during the Civil War. But after that then, when the war ended and things, people went back to their own lives. And lots of people have relatives, female relatives. They don't know what parts they took in Come the Man. And then because they had to literally fight for their pensions, a lot of women didn't apply for their pensions. A lot of women were not awarded for their pensions and they never told what they did or what activism they got up to, which is very unfortunate. It wasn't until the Pensions Act in 1934 that the criteria was widened. So that applied to every person who served in any of the forces from 1916 onwards. Eventually, they were listed as a qualifying organisation. But it wasn't until 1949 that two acts were amended by widening the career to include military activity, including running safe houses for men on the run, intelligence work, delivering weapons. Most of these jobs were undertaken by women. So then they could apply. But we have extraordinary stories of women applying. Like, you know, they try to, you know, Mary McBride from Dunloe, she was dispatch carrier during the War of Independence and Civil War. She died in 1924 and her father was awarded a partial dependence gratuity in 1934 because her death was caused, her illness was caused being out in all conditions and all weather. So it was deemed arisen from her service of Come the Man. It was a type of TB. And then we had Marianne McKay, which was in Churchill, and her family home during the Civil War was full of armed men. And for a month, she was in constant demand, catering, carrying out dispatch work and distributing war news. Because in Glenveagh, the anti-treaty force had their own printing press. They printed anti-treaty newspaper.
Yeah.
And then she collected mines and bombs, which were stored near her house, and dumped them safely.
So
extraordinary
dangerous.
Woman, like, and, you know, the extraordinary things she took with so much risk.
But that story is that you see the men fighting and it's like behind every good man there's a better woman.
There is, like, they keep the show on the road and they kept the men on the road as well and kept them the lines of communication open and they kept the house safe so that, you know, battalion meetings could take place. They could take in men and keep them safe. And then she also assisted Charlie Daly in carrying dispatches during the Civil War. And then we have women like Mary Ann Meehan from Frosses. She applied but she was refused and you could appeal the decision. And she said she joined the Ethnic Caribbean Come the Man in Frosses in 1918. She helped to organise and carry on dances in aid of the general election in 1918. And she was sworn in by a volunteer officer in 1921 and helped the IRA in every way it could. And she said during the raids on her father's house during the, which she calls the Black and Tan, then War of Independence and Civil War, I was abused by the Tans and members of the National Army, the Free State Army. And then she did guard while members of the Active Service, which is the Active Service units, which were the anti-treaty guerrilla forces, got refreshments or slept in my home. So, like, she was appealing and she was awarded a tiny pension.
Yeah.
Tiny pension compared to
what kind
of
abuse would she have suffered?
Well, she would have, you know, insults and she would have been threatened and then their house would be ransacked and goods would be taken and things like that, you know. And they'd be under constant surveillance as well because it's probably known that their house was a safe house.
Yeah.
And then, like, she'd be targeted as well. And, like, as you said, she was carrying arms and moving mines and carrying dispatches. So she was under threat at all times.
And even running the safe houses and having the arms, she was wide open for any kind of danger coming to her.
Of course. And, like, what they forget too as well, we have in the museum, we have, you know, a list of what was spent on them, feeding the men, you know, how much money is spent. And the women applied for, look, 16 men could arrive in the house. So people were turfed out of their beds. She'd have to feed them, clothe them, wash them, look after them and spend their own money.
And it wouldn't have been plentiful.
Wouldn't been plentiful at all. And they had to share what they needed to share. And it's like, as Charlie Daly says, had said that this county was assuredly, you know, poor. And he was very happy when they were on the run, even to get, you know, potatoes and salt or potatoes and butter or a bit of buttermilk as well. So people didn't have enough, but they were expected as well when people came in and the saver came in to stay that they had to feed them, look after them. And a lot of the times he didn't get reimbursed the money. Bills were outstanding, even though they were provided receipts from the forces. they weren't repaid.
And these women, they kind of wouldn't have had a choice whether the,
you know, and expected. If anybody came into your house and told you, you know, under carrying guns, I don't think you had a choice.
Yeah.
You know, whether what side you supported, you were expected to look after them, feed and wash them and look after the men as usual.
Another woman whose story has remained somewhat untold is that of Eileen Dalton McAdams, who continued to print a newspaper despite coming under continuous attacks.
She's an extraordinary character as well. She's another lady that's not at all well known, and she's an extraordinary woman. She's known as Eli, and her father was John McAdams, and he was invited to set up a newspaper called the Donegal Vindicator by the Land League and supporters of Charles Stuart Parnell. I started publishing in 1889. And then at the outbreak of the war, then the paper supported John Redmond and the Irish Parliamentary Party. And then two of her actual brothers fought in the First World War, I think with Dennis Gillins. And she started publishing herself a weekly pamphlet, Colin Dahl, in 1918, where she joined the local branch of Common the Man in Ballyshannon, and she became the officer commanding of the Ballantrae branch then eventually. So then in early 1921, her father appointed her the editor of the Donegal Vindicator. Very unusual. Wouldn't have been too many women editors of newspapers in Ireland. And her editorial was actively supporting the IRA. So then she was under threat as well, under surveillance. So on the 26th of January 1921, soldiers from Finner raided the Vindicator's office to search it. And herself and her sister Kathleen were searched, and she was arrested, first taken by train to Derry and then on to Armagh for further question. There she wasn't charged, but she was released, and released to make her own way home as well. And then during the Civil War, the premises were attacked by both the pro and anti-treaty, so she wasn't safe from any side. She said, shortly after midnight on Saturday, armed men entered the premises of the Donegal Vindicator and, gaining access to the machine room, smashed the vital parts of the large printing press, a smaller machine and a petrol engine. Amongst the wreckage found in the morning was a large hammer broken into parts and a twisted roller used to lever in the work of destruction. The proprietor and his family, who resided on the premises, were held up by the raiders. The editor, Miss McAdams, endeavoured to attract attention, threw a vase through the window onto the street to look for help. And then, despite the ongoing intimidation, the paper continued to support and report on the anti-treaty force. And it was the only paper in the area that actually were prominently anti-treaty. So she was an extraordinary woman. She went on later on after the war. She used to write plays for RTE and produce plays and things like that. She was an extraordinary woman.
Yeah, and despite the intimidation, as you mentioned, such a strong woman and determined
And after all the attacks, like in the printing press, and the anti-treaty force would come and raid parts for their printing press. They needed parts for their printing press in Glenveagh. And the other side was breaking it up to stop the dissemination of information and pro-treaty. So she's an extraordinary woman to keep going in the face of extraordinary adversity.
Women at the time didn't need to be associated with any particular side during the conflict to be singled out. Many going about their daily lives would have been targeted and subjected to sexual abuse, kidnapping and head shaving.
Ordinary women, all ages of women. And it was carried about by all sides in the War of Independence Civil War. There wasn't any good sides. They're all equally as capable of violence and attacks against women. There's no good sides and nothing good to be said about any of the sides, really. The women were subjected to head shaving, head bobbing, threats, intimidation, even kidnapping. And like women and children were caught up in the crossfire and during ambushes and raids as well. And as you said, they were kind of held to ransom as well when groups of men arrived into your house and told them you had to feed and look after them as well. So it was very, probably a very scary time for a woman. Like, you know, and as you know, women's rights were completely different at the time. You know, you didn't have very many rights and you literally had to do what the men told you to do.
And would they have targeted homes like, say, they knew a man was away fighting, or it could have been anybody?
It could have been anybody, independent of what was happening at the time or dependent. But yeah, probably. And they targeting people maybe had relatives previously in the RIC, maybe men who were fought in the First World War. Maybe you knew women were on their own. As you said, husbands were away working or away fighting, or maybe were members of the whatever side they considered the opposite side as well.
Even for a woman to have her hair shaven, thinking about that now, you know, it's just
it's always been a common form of punishment, you know, and you know, it's like Ryan's daughter, you know, you see her hair being shaved and bobbed, whatever. So it's instantly recognizable, because women you know, women love their hair, and if they have short hair, it was completely against the style of the time. So you knew they were attacked for some reason, or they were considered to have done something wrong. So like, it's like Ellen Gillan down in Ballyshannon. She was a boarder and staying in Erin Street. She was dragged out of the house by four armed and masked men. You know, she was only a small woman. They cut off all her hair. They beat her and made her swear not to return to work at the police barracks, and left her in a field in the town. And after suffering from severe nervousness, she lived and worked. They took her into the barracks to protect her and lived and worked there for 9 weeks. And they had only had reason how they'd let her go after 9 weeks is because they were getting more policemen were coming. They'd know where to put her. And then afterwards, she found it so difficult to get any employment.
Yeah.
And then she put a claim in then to the Ballyshannon Rural District Council, with a report from the RIC verified that she had head shaved previous month, and she was awarded £40 compensation at the quarter sessions, which, and I'm not sure what happened to them, but I'd say she found it difficult to, she probably had to leave or found it anywhere difficult, you know.
And would there have been support for somebody reporting them crimes, or like she had to fight for just £40 more or less?
Well, £40 had been quite a lot of money at the time. But yeah, there would have been people that would have helped her as well. There was a lot of claims at the time from all different people, from, you know, for everything and anything. So, you know, and she wasn't the only one that was claiming money. It's like two girls from South Donegal had their hair cut and they were assaulted by the IRA, and they were awarded £200 each in compensation. Mm. And sometimes you have to read between the lines.
Right.
But considering the amount of money, so you have to see how they were assaulted.
Right.
So you'd have
could have been a different level.
A different level with £200. £200 is an extraordinary amount of money in those days. And then we have Roseanne Logue, and like a lot of the attacks maybe weren't for political reasons. They were personal or for revenge or jealousy. Like Roseanne Logue, she was an instructress with the Congested Districts Board. And she was held up by two, she was on a bicycle and she was held up by two men pulling revolvers on her over in Mina Clally near Gullahork. And she was accused of keeping company with RIC and she was threatened to be shot. Then they cut off all her hair. So she had to leave her employment. She was a woman earning her own money, doing a respectable career, you know, a professional career. So she'd leave her employment in the district. And then she put in a compensation claim for £500 to, for having to leave her job in district at the Lifford Quarter Sessions, but she's only awarded £60.
Yeah,
losing
her job and...
Yeah, for losing her job and losing her able to home. And she was accused of putting a wreath on the grave, but it wasn't, there was a constable shot a number of weeks before that, and somebody had said that she had put the wreath in, but there's no evidence to say that she did. And like, what could happen is keeping company. You could actually be seen just talking to, and they assume that you were keeping company or you were passing something, and maybe you're just being polite and having the pass at time of day, you know, or having a conversation.
And there was no age barrier to this.
A woman in February 1921, she was dragged by about 10 armed and masked men, like extraordinary amount of men to take an old woman out. She's carried out to the field again and cut off her hair and badly assaulted her and beat her again because she accepted a job at the RIC. And you have to remember, this is a time where there was no social welfare.
Yeah.
If you didn't have money, if you didn't work, if you had nobody to support you or no means, you needed a job.
Yeah.
And like, she was an old woman at this stage, so she took a job because she probably didn't have there was an old age pension, things like that, but maybe she didn't have enough money to live.
There was desperate times, and then, you know.
Yeah, and people took a job.
She probably kind of thought about the consequences, but... She had no other choice than to take the job either.
So she didn't get her job, and she was badly beaten, her hair cut, and I think she had left to leave the district again. And then in Convoy a woman in Convoy had her hair cut off because she refused to give armed men anything to eat. And maybe that was because maybe she didn't have enough food in the house, maybe she didn't have enough to give anybody, or maybe she didn't feel like feeding all the armed men that arrived at her house. So like, for anything and everything, there was no rhyme or reason to it, and not all were done, as I said, for political reasons.
Yeah.
The most extraordinary incident happened in July 1922. The anti-treaty forces based at Glenveagh, they raided local farmhouses and they took several girls away to work. They kidnapped them. One mother went screaming with them and went on with her child on the lorry, and they threw her off a mile down the road. They didn't want her because they threw her off. So the girls were kidnapped. And these girls, I have to remember, these were hired out from West Donegal. And, you know, this caused huge hardship to them. One, that other girls in the area fled home. Normally when you're hired out, it's from May to November. So they were only there in July. And because they fled home, they wouldn't have got their pay. So that caused huge hardship at home. Yeah. They were, you know, and people who were hired, your families at home were depending on your money you got at the end of your hiring term to pay the bills and, you know, and to look after yourself. And because when they returned home, that family probably ended up in huge debt. And they were afraid to come back to the local area, afraid they were kidnapped. And like, it wasn't really reported on locally, because I say it caused huge fear. It was reported on in Reuters newspaper report and the Times report, but it was kind of crossed over.
Yeah.
Because it was such an atrocity, basically, that women were being kidnapped to work as servants, even though there was women like Etna Coyle out there and other women who were out in Glenveagh Castle, you know, volunteers or there for the anti-treaty sides, but they thought they had needed to take women to work as servants.
And if you put that story in now, would be absolutely crazy thinking that these guards are being kidnapped and
taken away by lorry. Yeah.
And it was not accepted back then, but it was the sign of the times.
Yeah, it was just lawlessness, general lawlessness at that time as well. So it was very, very sad.
The tragedy of women doesn't end there. During a bank robbery in Buncrana, a 9-year-old girl and a 19-year-old girl were killed. Again, two women losing their lives.
4th May 1922 was part of the anti-treaty needing money, basically. So they decided to rob the bank in Buncrana, but they were spotted. It was kind of, they were known, they were there. So after they were fired, they were waited, they were ambushed by the party of pro-treaty forces who were waiting for them in houses. They were waiting for them to come out. But anyway, they were fired on and shots were exchanged from both sides. But bystanders were there. There were several injured and two innocent bystanders were killed, including 9-year-old Essie Fletcher. And then later on, 19-year-old Mary Ellen Kavanagh, she died from wounds later on that month in the infirmary in Derry. So it's like, it was like a free-for-all, like a shootout. And unfortunately, two girls were killed. But and they later, the father later claimed compensation on behalf of Mary Ellen Kavanagh as well at the assizes too.
And it's women like that you do, you forget their story, you forget that they were part of it, they shaped what Donegal is today.
They did, and you know, and their two Donegal lives cut short, and they, you know, they were kind of forgotten about as well, that they were just in the crossfire, and they're like in the reports you see and different things, like they're just kind of disregarded in one line. You know, they're not even mentioned their name or somebody was killed, but they're kind of just written off. You know, just a line reported, but nothing. You know, nobody going to their homes to sympathise with them, or it was just part of collateral damage, I suppose you call it nowadays.
There was much destruction caused and many bared the financial burden. As a result, the Irish Distress Committee, later named the Irish Grants Committee, was established to help those who had suffered as a result of their loyalism.
A lot of people don't realise that in May 1922, the British government established an Irish Distress Committee to provide relief for Irish loyalists. And people think the term loyalist is only Protestant and loyal to the Crown. But there's Catholic loyalists. There was Irish people loyal to the Crown as well, even though they were Catholic. The Irish loyalists, both Catholic and Protestant and Presbyterian, suffered and experienced losses like their houses being burnt, shops being burnt, having to flee, you know, losing their jobs during the War of Independence. So then in March 1923, because of the Civil War then too, it was renamed the Irish Grants Committee, and it was aimed to compensate Irish loyalists who suffered during the Civil War. So we have in June 1922, Annabel Rainey, who owned a drapery shop in Milford, she had to leave and close her business due to continuous intimidation by a picket outside her shop, Belfast boycott again being enforced. So she lost her business. And then Catherine McLaughlin from her foe stated, like many families, we suffered greatly from the Irregulars, the anti-treaty forces campaign. So it was a compensation scheme around for a number of years, and it's a very interesting scheme. And that's what people forget. Irish loyalist doesn't mean Protestant. And also, it doesn't mean a lot of people who got compensation as well weren't loyal to the Crown either.
Yeah.
So it was a compensation scheme for anybody who suffered the losses, but it doesn't mean that you're a loyalist in modern terms.
Now looking back on the time, or what we know now, it's funny that that piece of history is forgotten as well.
It's an unusual piece of history that it's like a cross-border scheme.
Yes.
You know, it's a joint government scheme that recompensed people who didn't get it through the court system or the SI system as well.
The 1920s in Donegal brought with it many years of poverty. The economy was far from booming due to the pro and anti-treaty sides fighting against each other.
As I said, there was no social welfare, you know, and it was basically during the War of Independence and Civil War and partition, all it meant for local, ordinary, everyday people was that the change in Irish politics, all it did was one type of government being replaced by another. And like, you know, there was a decline in agriculture. Fishing had declined. The fish stocks disappeared. The shoals disappeared off the coast at that time. Increasing unemployment and then immigration. Of course, continued unrest and then just general widespread poverty amongst ordinary everyday people in Donegal. And then these continuous raids, including the raids by Ethnic Oil on the railways, caused, you know, goods and supplies and mail deliveries to be disrupted and delayed. Then train services were stopped. People couldn't get to where they were going, couldn't get their jobs, couldn't get their goods. So food prices went up. There was, you know, lack of newspapers, so the men couldn't know when there was jobs in Scotland. They didn't know what time the boats were arriving back in Derry. So they had to, they couldn't maybe get by train. They had to walk all the way to Derry. They had to stay at the quayside and no accommodations. They didn't spend money till they know what time the boats were. And then they didn't know when the British newspapers were, they didn't know what jobs were being advertised.
Yes.
So they went off to Scotland then too. And a lot of them had to come home because there was no work.
And the cost of
Going there.
Over and coming back.
And then they were relying on the men's, you know, wages to pay off the shop bills and pay off to enable them to survive during the winter.
So that's like two sides of the coin. You have Ethnic Oil doing what she believed was right, but then
it had
such an impact then.
Oh yeah, for ordinary poor people or ordinary everyday people in Donegal trying to keep a roof over their heads and food on the table, it had huge consequences.
The hallmarks of those times and those people fleeing to Scotland are still evident today in Donegal, with almost all families in the county affected. To this day, the majority of us know or have a relation that spent time in Scotland.
For centuries, you know, people have been going to for seasonal migration or moving there over or migrating or immigrating over and back to Scotland. And it's an important part of our Donegal history. But it's just people don't realise the disruption, the you know, the lack of trains or the unrest during the War of Independence and the Civil War caused to people trying to go about their everyday lives.
Yeah. Living in that danger and then you don't know when the food's coming or if it's
You don't know whether you have money to pay the, you know, the shop bills or you have money to put food on the table, basically.
And for women at the time, what would it have been like going into employment? Would there have been many opportunities?
Well, as that time, many women left school. If, you know, they were allowed to stay in school and their primary education finished normally about the age of 13 or 14. And then only a tiny percent continued on education unless they got a scholarship or maybe they had money. And then women, of course, there was opportunities to be trained as nurses or teachers or join the civil service. But most women were expected to stay at home, marry and rear the children and do what they were told. But as I said, the women were often ended up the breadwinners when the men were out on revolutionary activities or were away, had to hold the homes together, families together, when the men were away working. Mm. They were the women who looked after the farm, looked after the children and kept life going when the men were away working. So then they became often involved trying to earn some money themselves. Poultry and sold eggs. It was a very big business. Cottage industry, knitting jumpers or socks or embroidery. And they worked maybe locally gutting or packing fish. And then, of course, we have women, all women and children from age 8 onwards, being hired, including the men too, being hired out at the herring fairs in Letterkenny or Strabane for 6 months at a time to work in the lagan, to which their families depend on to support and pay the bills. And then you had factories too. And then you women worked in domestic servants or in shops. But women were always paid less than men.
Yes.
You know, and the women every year in June went off, women and teenage girls went off to Scotland to Tatyhook as well, famous Tatyhookers harvesting the potato crop. And they sent the valuable money home every week.
And it was physically hard work.
Oh, they were expected to do the same as the men, basically. And it was hard, strenuous work. And, you know, there's good employers and bad employers and everybody in between, unfortunately. And then we had Morton, the famous Donegal carpets factories. They're extraordinary business industry in Donegal. But in October 1923, they announced they were going to close their carpet factories at Annagrey and Crawley. And they had employed over 300 women, which is a huge amount of women. And these are, this is women earning their own money for probably the first time in independence. But when those factories closed then, that caused like women to have what options, very little options to have, and caused a lot of emigration as well.
And even to kind of get to their place of employment would have been a task also.
Oh, well, yeah, having a bicycle, hopefully, would be, or maybe very few probably would have went by train, but most people just walked. They were employed locally as well. So it was a big shock to that local economy that a factory was closing.
Yeah, especially 300. We might think women. It's a big number now, but...
It was a lot of the time, and that was 300 women earning their own money to supplement, their, you know, for themselves or for their family as well. And that would have been a devastating.
1919 saw a shift in how women were viewed in Ireland. In the following years, the First Lady Magistrate would be sworn in Donegal and women would be granted the right to vote, a step many over the decades fought for and something us now living in the 21st century take for granted.
It was called the Sex Disqualification Removal Act, became law. And then for the first time, women become barristers, solicitors, jurors and magistrate. So then in March 1921, we had Donegal's First Lady Magistrate. She was sworn in Donegal Town. And she was Miss Nellie Neilson, who's the daughter of Reverend Robert and Ellen Neilson, who's the minister in Donegal Town. The welcoming solicitor welcomed Nellie, and she said, you know, more than capable. And it was a long time coming. Yeah. There should have been women magistrates.
And that would have been
before.
A big statement.
Oh,
then.
Yeah. In 1922, then, we had Article 12 of the Constitution there at Free State, which granted women over the age of 21 the right to vote. Unfortunately, only if they're women graduates, university graduates, householders or the wives of householders, occupiers of land or premises of a yearly value of not less than £5. And then the Constitution then also guaranteed all citizens, religious and civil liberty, equal rights and equal opportunities, regardless of their gender, which is an extraordinary statement. So then we had six anti-treaty women TDs, and they argued that all women over age 21 should be given the vote in advance of the forthcoming 1922 election on equal basis as men. Alfred Griffith and Michael Collins refused, claiming the electorate could not be updated in time, but they suspected maybe a lot of the young women might vote anti-treaty. So it went ahead then, just without the votes of any women under 30. So then in 1923, then the fourth dial, young women between the ages of 20 and 30 were now included in the franchise. So we had five women elected TD, including the most famous names we have, Irish women, Kathleen Brewer, Kathleen Lynn, Mae McSweeney, Constance Markovich and Margaret Collins O'Driscoll. Then we see then there's a shift in government then, and women's rights were completely wiped and been eroded at that stage.
And at the time, how much of a fight would that have been to get to that stage?
You know, Arthur Griffin and Michael Collins refusing because they didn't trust, they thought women were so easily swayed and they didn't trust them to have their own opinions, or they thought they'd be told what to do by their fathers and husbands, or, you know.
So they wouldn't use their own voice?
Yes, kind of. That they thought they were, you know, they couldn't be trusted. But the 1923 election was, you know, 20 and 30 were now included in the franchise, which is extraordinary.
Yeah, hugely significant then. From 1912 to 1923, following on from that, the aftermath of it, like it was felt for many years.
Oh, and the repercussions of the Civil War still continues.
Yeah.
You know, and you still have people, you know, that don't want to talk about it or don't want to engage about it as well, because maybe what happened to their family or their relatives, because it was very bitter. And it's still some counties more than Donegal, or it's even more bitter. We got off lightly compared to other counties in Ireland, but we can still see the repercussions of the Civil War, and we can see it like in politics, you know, and the extraordinary, you know, of the coalition government we have now with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, which most people didn't believe it could possibly happen, that they joined together and go into government together. Over the years, like, fact and myths have become blurred. And this true story of the revolution story, you know, it's not known or forgotten, and maybe families have a certain story which may not be the correct, or the maybe not the true version of the facts, or maybe they were told something happened and it turned, when you do a bit of research, it's absolutely the opposite of what happened. And then a lot of the things that happened maybe in the Civil War, as I said, weren't for political reasons. There were revenge, land grabs, things that still have repercussions in localities as well.
Yeah.
And then attacks and murders that were carried out for other reasons under the guise of the Civil War.
We talked about, you were saying that some things they might have tried to forget, or some things they didn't tell. But say the woman being attacked, would there have been a sense of shame on the family?
Oh, of course, it would have been a terrible shame, and the, particularly just saying the head bobbing was a terrible sign.
Yeah,
you know, a terrible stigma. You know, because your hair was your pride and joy at the time. Like, and it would have been very noticeable if you were attacked. You was a mark of shame on your family, and especially like to losing your job, or if you're targeted. You know, your family was targeted and things like that too. And there's some terrible stories, and there's other terrible stories to be told, uncovered and told yet. And a lot of people, they're saying, oh, they don't talk about them. Well, what we find at older people, they didn't talk about them, they didn't discuss them, and they kept going.
Yeah.
That's what it is. And they couldn't, because we can't relate to what it was like at the time. Thank goodness we haven't gone through the same, we didn't have any of the same experiences they have. And like, they were happy to keep going. And when the Civil War kind of petered out rather than ended, people probably closed that book and just heads down and keep going.
And it's amazing to see what them women came through to what it did shape our lives now today, being able to vote and just our life now.
It is, like, and when you're talking to young people and you find, like, did you vote? No, why would I vote? And like, they don't understand what it took to get a vote for women and how important it is for our voices to be heard. And like, and like in local elections that are coming up now, you can see some people are being elected by a handful of votes, and every single vote counts. And you need to have your vote. If you want to have an opinion, you need to vote. And if you want to change something, you can't rely. Why rely on somebody else? Do it yourself.
And all them women we talked about had some impact on someone's life or some impact on years to come. So we can talk about them.
And they, what they went through to get us to here. You know, we aren't in a perfect position, but we're extraordinary. You can't imagine them looking 100 years on from 1923 and seeing in the position, and me and you sitting here.
Yeah, I know.
You know, being allowed to talk.
Two women.
Two women to be allowed, discuss and have an opinion.
Yeah.
So without having to ask somebody else's permission.
Or asking the man, what are we going to say?
Or we have jobs, we have careers, we're we can do it ourselves.
The untold stories of Donegal women in the revolutionary period shows that they are clearly a force to be reckoned with. They, like the men who physically fought for what they believe in, deserve their place rightfully cemented in the history books. From the likes of Ethna Coyle, who was a central figure in Cumann na mBan in Donegal, to women who ran safe houses, who looked after the family while the man of the house was on another mission, to the ordinary woman who got caught in the crossfire by simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. They were all a central part of life from 1912 onwards. The strength and courage of Donegal women during the First World War, 1916, the War of Independence and the Civil War is remarkable and has shaped the lives of the female cohort of the population today. Their stories are inspiring. They put up a fight and never laid down to any adversities they encountered along their path. We remember all the women we've discussed in this episode and the many more who fought their own battles to eventually win their rightful place in society. We conclude with the words of Mary Ballantyne. Her husband, Joseph Ballantyne, was head constable of the Royal Irish Constabulary. At 4 a.m. on May the 21st, 1922, having just retired from his role in the force, three men entered their home in Raphoe on the pretense that he was needed to identify a prisoner. They shot him dead.
If I hear a knock at the front door at night, it sends a shiver through me. It brings the shock of that night back to me as if it were yesterday. My Joseph was an honourable man. He served crown and country. He was the head constable of the RIC at Raphoe. We had just celebrated his retirement, and we were full of plans to move to Tyrone to be with our own people. Joseph had given a lifetime of service to the RIC, and 20 days later, his life was over. Three stranger men from across the border saw to that. Anti-treaty men, they were. I learned that later at the inquest. Three men arriving into our Christian home in the night. Them with their dirty lies and their filthy trench coats. And Joseph saw them, he had unknowing. And a fear took hold of him. He fainted. I was sent to get a drink to revive him. And it was then that I heard the shots ring out, echo through our house, shatter the peace of our home. Two shots that left me a widow. I hear them still.
You can listen back to this and subsequent episodes on our website, highlandradio.com. Next week, the stories of the Donegal casualties and survivors from the First World War behind the walls will be brought to life by Donegal County Museum curator Judith McCarthy. This podcast series was funded by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sports and Media under the Community Strand of the 2023 Decade of Centenaries programme as part of the Decade of Centenaries Initiative 2012 to 2023.